Today is Monday, September 13th, 2021. I just want to mention, Jack sent me a photograph, an email of Nechama Leibovitch and her attitude towards Das Torah. And I have to say, this is pristine Nechama. When she gets a little bit upset about telling the people who say rabbis are perfect, everything they say, you must listen, etc., etc. And she says they've turned the rabbis into Stalin. And that is Nechama Leibovitch, says Zichrona Tzadeket Levracha. But I only wish Nechama were here to see what I'm going to publish on rabbis and rabbinical authority, and I think she'll be very, very pleased. But all right, we'll leave that when it appears in print. Then the first part of it will be published in a volume coming out on the Rav's 30th Yard site, and then the major part, it'll all be together, but with a real major piece, it'll come out in Rakafar Aron Chelekei Be'ezrat HaNotein LeYav Koach, and you can. We'll see if I hit the nail on the head or whether I struck out. Be'ezrat Hashem. Okay. I want to mention that I've gotten tremendous response to these lectures on yesterday's shiur already. I got maybe six or seven different emails and tremendous response to what we're doing in the Monday class. And I'm very happy to show you. We mentioned Yaakov Birnbaum, and what's going to be published in the Rav's memory on the 30th Yard site, I have a very important footnote about his grandfather, and it ties in with the Rav, something the Rav was just published in Tradition. You'll see it. It's a Melechet Machshava. So a Talmud listener, Ilan Rizo, who is from the Adat Yeshurin community, the Adat Yeshurin, has lived all his life, a lifelong resident of Washington Heights. So he wanted me to know that Yaakov Birnbaum, is not forgotten. And take a look. There's a Cabrini Boulevard in Washington Heights, Yaakov Birnbaum Way. So they had a dedication, and his wife is alive and active, Freda, and I have to say that you have no idea how much we owe that man, what he did for the Jewish people. There are no children, so there's no one to fight for the legacy, but as one who risked his life for helping our brethren behind the Iron Curtain, I know what we owe Yaakov Birnbaum. Don't let me go a step further, and I can't. The people walk in and walk out, and I want to say something for the new faces. You walked into a class that began a year or two after the Sunday class. I began the Sunday class when the Kollel began a formal program in 1978, and it was a year or two later that the Kollel students bothered me to do something additional beyond strict halacha, shas paiskim, machshava. So I began, it was originally Tuesday, and many years later it switched to Monday, the Monday class. Of course, Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein wanted Tuesday, and I was able to accommodate him. By then I had stopped my collegiate teaching, only postgraduate, and I was able to give him a Tuesday, and I took Monday. And what have I taught in this class? I spent 22 years on the Rav, out of a few lectures, came my two volumes on the Rav. It doesn't represent 22 years, it represents actually about 2-3 months of lectures. Then I remember I spent a good 10 years on questions my students have asked me and what I answered. And what I'm publishing next goes back to to some of the questions and my answer. And about 10 years ago or more, I explained, I'll say it one last time this year, even if new faces come in after Sukkot, I hope they'll pick it up on the tape. When you have a mother, you're young. And every morning I would drop into my mother, who lived across the way in Givat Mordechai and see how my mom is, and mom would say, "Hi, Arnie, how are you?" And you're young. About 10 years ago already, 11 years ago, my mother took ill. She was 95. She fell. Until she fell, she was basically fine. And I recognized, wow, time is flying. And then I learned Rabbi Lichtenstein was quite ill. And I remember I was absolutely shocked. And I said to myself, until that happened, I never taught what I knew. If you've studied my seventh volume, I believe it is Washington. So in Washington, I tell you that the Rav taught me never to teach, never teach what you know, the Rav said. Teach what you don't know. That way you learn and the students learn. And in all my lectures, I absolutely have never taught anything from the day I came in Aliyah. In America, I was a Rebbe, I was a Rosh Yeshiva, I was a Rama. I taught Gemara, Rashi, Tosfot, Rambam. But here, I absolutely never gave a shir in anything I knew, anything that anyone taught me. And when my mother was ill and Reb Aaron was ill, I decided, you better get it out of your system because you know things that not many others know. And I decided to teach something I know. And I began the history of Torah in the United States and the Western world. That's what you're coming into. If you take off a few years, listen to all the lectures and pick up all the history we've spoken about. Now, we finished last year. We did Teira Vidas. We did Torah Mesorah. But before I went on to Satma, I felt I owed a debt to three people that have to be understood. And as I explained last year and I explained last time here, this was the era that I was born into. These people are all, the Rebbetzin was not really older than me, but Schleimela certainly was older, and Meir was, Schleimela was born in the 20s, but Meir was born 32, I was born 37, I think the Rebbetzin was born 36. And we grew up, the Holocaust and the State of Israel. And it was a different life growing up then. And these people wanted to change the world. So we began last term, you can pick it up on YU Torah, we started talking about Schleimela Kalbach. So I just want to mention a Talmud, he's a second generation Talmud. Jacob Steinhardt, his father Michael Steinhardt. We go back a long way. We go back to the 60s. And Jacob heard my lectures on Reb Schleimela, and he wrote to me something beautiful that should be recorded, because this captures Schleimela as he actually was. A few years after I returned from Israel, I had an encounter with Schleimela Kalbach that left an indelible impression on me. I recounted below, and he tells the story. There was a bris in my shul that morning. It was 1994, Chol Hamoed Sukkos, the rabbi's first son, born after seven girls. And wow, you can imagine, after seven girls, you finally have a son. And there was a great anticipation. The baby was born on Yom Kippur. And they invited Schleimela Kalbach to entertain, came with his guitar. And then Reb Schleimela appeared at the door, lulav and etrog in one hand and a guitar case in the other. I ran to help him carry his stuff. "Thank you," he said. "The doctor said I shouldn't be carrying so much." I walked with him to a row of empty seats. He laid his lulav down across two of them. Then he took out his talis and began davening. A few minutes later, one of the little boys in shul was running in the aisle, and he banged against the top of Shlomo's lulav. I gasped. I was a yeshiva boy, and I knew that the most important thing on circus was to protect the kashrut of your lulav and etrog. You don't let anything smack against the tip of your lulav because you can damage the top leaf. This wasn't a simple accident. This was a huge deal. My friend, who happened to be the older brother of the child offender, was somewhat less traumatized by the incident and decided to have a little fun. He grabbed his brother and said, "Hey, Shlomo, this kid is messing with your lulav." Shlomo was focusing on his davening, but he looked around without even pausing or considering. He said, "What do you mean he's messing with my lulav? It's an honor that he's playing with my lulav." My jaw dropped. Shlomo always talks about blowing your mind out over such things. He blew my mind right then. The way he said it, so matter-of-factly, so naturally, made me realize he really meant it. And that's Shlomo LeKalbach. Anyone who knew him, you know, he died penniless. I don't know if you're aware of it. They had to raise money to pay for his funeral. These are tzaddikim. These are people. He gave it all away. I write about Reb Lazer Silver, so you can read. Everything I wrote is absolutely accurate. This is not portraying it in an overdone fashion. Reb Lazer, the shul wouldn't pay his salary. They used to give it to his wife, because they knew if they gave him the money, by the time he walked home from the shul, someone would come and give him a hard luck story as to marry off a daughter, and all the money would disappear. And that was Shlomo, a total, total dedication. Okay, now, we spoke about at the end of the last time we met. And we spoke about the, with Reb Shlomo, that we spoke about Rabbi David Trenk. I can't repeat it all. But with Shlomo LeKalbach, you know, we have problems, the way he acted, women, etc. And I explained my attitude based upon the Gemara in Pesachim and Baruch Hashem, the Gemara in Brachot. And I wanted to show you that I'm not the only one who thinks that way. And I quoted about Rabbi David Trenk dealing with someone from the right-wing world, well-accepted, Mir Lakewood, and his attitude towards Reb Shlomo. So I just want to make one correction, and the correction requires a little story. I kept on saying that Reb David Trenk opened the yeshiva, a very special yeshiva. I heard many wonderful things about it. And in near Lakewood, and I used the word Adelphi. It's not Adelphi. It's not Adelphi. It's Adelphia, if I'm pronouncing it right. Adelphia. And I apologize, because Adelphi always played Yeshiva College every year. In my time, I don't know today, there was a game, I think it's a Catholic university, and everyone got upkickets, and they prayed. I remember you would see them praying before the, I don't know how happy I am that you, before you play a basketball game, you pray to the Ribbono Shel Olam, Ana Hashem Hoshiana, Hashem Hatzlichana. I don't know if we have to dignify. I'm a big baseball fan, but there are limits to how seriously I take Judge and Stanton. Okay, but...
backwards was see-through, and there was a
tailor
on each side.
A tailor and the court. All right. It's a Catholic school. It's a Catholic school. But so I made a mistake, and absolutely, and as a kid, Adelphi. So the minute you read quickly, Adelphia, it's Tucker Adelphia. So a Talmud, I have a wonderful Talmud for many, many decades. He's been my Talmud generations already. Mark Licht. So Rabbi Dr. Mark Licht. So he sent me an email correcting me. So I said to him, "Why didn't you correct me when I made the mistake?" So he said, "Well, I'm looking at you from Brooklyn." He's on the screen. And he's muted. So I say, "Well, after when I tell everyone to unmute," he says, "Rebbe, if I correct you, it's embarrassing for you." I say, "Embarrassing? I'm the happiest guy in the world when someone corrects me. It shows you're listening to me." Ribbono Shel Olam, a human being, and we don't know it all, and we all make mistakes. So he said, yeah, but people would say I'm a chutzpan if I correct you. So I want to state publicly, I plead with everyone, correct me, and I'll tell you why. You do me a chesed, you understand? Why? If you correct me on the spot, I correct myself. If you don't correct me on the spot, you send me an email. First, I have to hope the email gets here. You saw it went on today until they got me on screen. Then I have to hope I see the email, I get too many emails, I remember the email, etc., etc. And then I have to hope I remember a week later, don't forget to correct yourself. So please, don't worry. If you don't correct me, you're a chutzpan. If you do correct me, you're a fabulous, wonderful Talmud. Okay. And then we went from Rav Shlomo. We started Meir Kahana, the shiur today. I don't know if we'll finish it, but the whole shiur will be devoted to Meir Kahana. Now, I want to state that a Talmud also, when I got this email, I was Manny Bahar. He's married to a Talmud. As I recall, I believe her name was Esther Gross. Manny, when you listen, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's, as I recall, the wonderful Talmidim came in Aliyah, helped build Israel, Baruch Hashem. So I mentioned last week that in the 60s, if you recall, the 60s, are a chapter that has never really been fully studied. Where was Meir? What did he do? Remember I told you he lost the rabbinate, delivered newspapers, his enemies published books, he worked for the FBI, he worked for the CIA, he was involved with that woman, Donna, with this. We really don't know for sure. But one thing I can tell you for sure, he taught high school in Central Yeshiva of Queens, Kew Gardens Hills. I had many students that he taught who later came to Israel during the collegiate years were my students in BMT, Beis Medrash LaTorah. So I want to tell you my memory was absolutely correct. I just listened to your shiur on my 10th grade Jewish philosophy teacher, Rabbi Meir Kahana. Rabbi Kahana taught at Yeshiva High School of Queens, which was in Jamaica. So it wasn't today. I know the elementary school is in Kew Gardens Hills, but the high school was in Jamaica, at least then, in 1969. The high school was a spin-off of the Yeshiva of Central Queens Elementary School, which was frequently referred to as YCQ Elementary School, has since moved to Kew Gardens Hills. Yeshiva High School moved to a building in Jamaica States, which is now the home of Yeshiva University High School for Girls. I went with Rabbi Kahana to a few demonstrations, but was never arrested. Rabbi Kahana left the school in the middle of the year. While no announcement was made, it was widely believed that he was fired because parents complained he was taking students to demonstrations and using his class to promote a political agenda. He was an excellent and inspiring teacher. And I know the students that I had, who had Rabbi Kahana, they had, I would say, that icing on the cake, not just from kids, not just kids who want to learn Gemara, but there was a zest, there was commitment, and that was Meir. All right, so I just wanted to confirm. Now, I just want to deal with one more question before I go further. So, Mark, again, I go back to Rabbi Dr. Mark Licht. He asked me, Rebbe, why don't you mention Rabbi Teitz? You're mentioning the Soviet Jewry issue, Shlomo Kalbach, Meir Kahana, why not Rabbi Teitz? So, first of all, I have to tell you, Mark, geduld. You know what the word geduld means, Shlomo? What are you, the word geduld? Patience. You have to understand, Shlomo, I'm a third generation American. In seventh grade, my Rebbeim didn't speak a word of English and I didn't speak a word of Yiddish. They were the Shanghai survivors. So Baruch Hashem, it was either sink or swim, all right? Today I was convinced when I learned in Lakewood that the Torah was given in Yiddish, okay? Zach, absolutely correct. I have many great-great-grandchildren with Moroccan blood, with Libyan blood, with Persian blood. Arfi, Bani Shalalem, Yiddish. I'm still convinced. Humor me, get it? Take the Rebbe, a grain of salt, but understand a little bit beneath the surface. Reb Dov Tzvi, when my gedul, the little patience, when my work comes out on rabbinic authority, you will understand Rabbi Teitz and myself, and if you put it together with what I wrote about Rabbi Teitz in Washington, you'll have a bit of a picture. And maybe if you bother me a few years from now, Rebbe, give a few lectures on Rabbi Teitz. All right, I'll acquiesce, believe me. But now let me explain to you. Rabbi Teitz and Shloimele and Meir, and let's take Meir versus Rabbi Teitz, because Shloimele Kalbach really was, he did not start the picture, he was brought into it. But it's like comparing night and day. It's like comparing red or dead. Do you remember that? Red or dead. Howie, you remember it. Believe me, Barak doesn't know what we're talking about. Barak, take out one of the earliest editions of tradition, if not the first one. There's an article from Rabbi Dr. Normie Lamb, Zeichet Tzadik Livracha. If the communists capture America, are we better off being red, or should we commit hari-kari like in Masada, or dead? Syria, were you ever on a debating team? Normie, in your time or not? Not your time already. One of the main topics of debate, red or dead, okay? This is, now let me explain myself. With Russian Jewry, Reb Meir, Triple SJ, demonstrations, we were working outside the system. We were working with anger, enmity towards Stalin, towards Brezhnev. Khrushchev was a little bit better, but how do you treat Jews like this, etc.? How do you eradicate religion? Rabbi Teitz totally worked within the system. Totally. If Meir Kahane, you would mention Rabbi Teitz to Meir Kahane, he would call him a KGB agent. You follow? Totally within the system. First of all, you have to know Rabbi Teitz had one tremendous advantage. What was his native language? Russian. His native street language. I'm sure at home he grew up in Yiddish. But his native language was Russian. And he knew the system. He knew the mentality. He knew how to double talk, how to placate. Give me another name of a rabbi. New Mark, one of our rabbis, Rabbinical Council of America, Arthur Schneier. Right or wrong, these are all rabbis here, all rabbis, all my students. Many became rabbis. Some are very prominent rabbis. Some can pick up the phone to Bennett and they can curse each other over the phone and laugh. You got it? Rabbi, who was Bennett's Chavruta when he studied in Yavne Yeshiva in Patterson, future Prime Minister of Israel? Rabbi Goldberg, Boca Raton, right or wrong? Anyway, come back here. Arthur Schneier, Elliot, right within the system. Arthur Schneier, pictures, communist, priest. Listen, Rabbi Teitz printed Siddurim that the Russian government allowed him to distribute in shuls. He couldn't go out of the shul where the shul system couldn't be taken out. The KGB watched, but you had shul, there's Rabbi Teitz. Now, is this a conflict? The truth is you need both. each one plays a role. And here I want to show you, Talmud sent me this, and it captures exactly what I'm saying to you, and it also shows, see, a person who people turn to, people think you're very smart, you're very this, you're very that. People turn to me, I learned in life. I know a limited amount. All right, there's some areas I'll admit I know. As well as anyone or even better. Baruch Hashem, some areas. There are other areas where I can tell you is I know as much as you do. But if I know who to refer you to, then I'm doing you a big chesed. You follow? You'll see here the Lubavitcher Rebbe. This is the greatness. And here's the story. It's a Breslov story. It's right now, all the news is about Breslov, and they're going to destroy the country. They're coming back. They say 1,800 tested positive. It's nothing to joke about, but as someone who, I'm lucky to be alive, so I don't want to minimize what Corona can do to you. God have mercy. God have mercy. My best friend is not alive. I caught it from Sam Dershowitz, and he's gone. They worked 3 months in the hospital. 3 months they kept him, couldn't save him. So it's Breslov. And during the communist era, it became extremely dangerous to visit the burial site of the Rebbe. But there used to be a small group coming, people who knew how to bribe within Russia. And this individual, Reb Michal, was one of the last remaining Breslova in the Ukraine. Many of the others were either murdered during the Bolshevik Revolution and subsequent wars, or they had gotten out of the country. And this Michal spent 6.5 years in the suburban gulag. He was in prison, labor camp. Siberian, what did I say? Suburban, I'm mixing up countries. Siberian gulag. In the 70s, he was allowed to leave Russia. And he came to Israel, settled in Israel, and became one of the elders of Breslov in Jerusalem. In 1979, a message reached Reb Michal. Who was it from? A non-Jewish lady, Mrs. Zubaida, who lived next to Reb Nachman's tomb in the Ukraine. And this lady took care of the tomb during the communist period. You should know that where Rav Kook is buried, 19 years it was in the hands of the Jordanians, and when Israel liberated Jerusalem, Mountain of Olives, the tomb, the Rav Kook's area, totally clean, totally nice. It was one Arab who said, I know that a holy man is buried there, and I cut the grass. I saw to it that no one harmed these graves. So you see, you have individuals like that. And this is Zubaida, got a message to Israel that they're planning to build large Soviet-type housing, including destroying the keva of Reb Nachman. Well, they didn't know what to do, the elders in Jerusalem, and this lady was reliable. They knew this non-Jewish lady, they knew what she did, and a message like that, they knew that this was reliable. So they decided that Reb Michal should go to New York and talk with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. By the way, his last name, which is of interest to Yomo, Reb Michal Dorfman, Mamish Dorfman, the name of your chaver, my Talmud. And he should go and talk with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He goes to New York, goes to Farbrengen, looks the Rebbe, tells the Rebbe who he is, where he's coming from, what the problem is, and he pleads with the Rebbe to intervene. And the Rebbe tells him on the spot, quote, the person you need to be in touch with is Rabbi Pinchas Teitz. He's the one who can help you. And immediately goes to Elizabeth, contacts the Pinchas Tides, and Reb Michal and I went to tell him the whole story. And Reb Tides, very smart, let me verify it. You know, you don't want to work on rumors. Rabbi Tides verifies it, pulls out a letter written on White House stationery out of his file cabinet. Let me read this to you, Rabbi Tides said. The letter was signed by Robert Lipschitz, a close friend of President Jimmy Carter and the White House counsel. It was a letter written on behalf of the President and the United States government. When Jimmy Carter was running for president, the leaders of the Jewish community pretty much ignored him. He was a religious, not a Christian. He was a born-again Christian. He was a real, he really was a pious individual. I know this is not a bluff. He didn't play around with women. I don't have to tell you who we have presidents. Clinton, God so love him. On this level, Trump is a great friend of Israel, but I wouldn't give him an A plus for his marital behavior. JFK, Ribbono Shel Olam, the stories. I have a lot to say on this. This is why the Rav, we used to complain to the Rav, Rebbe, why do we study Greek mythology? We used to have it in high school and college. Greek mythology, the god, they made it, they ripped the steel, they seduce. Why do we the Rav said, what? This is the way you will understand Western civilization. If these are the gods doing it, imagine what the people can do. You understand? Elu Elohecha Yisrael. This is Western civilization. This is Ribbono Shel Olam. Your friend from Atlanta, Julia Hart. Exactly her. And we, Kedusha, Tara, God, Kadosh, think for a moment, sanctity, Kadoshim Tiyu, Kadosh Ani Hashem, there's no religion like ours. Kadesh Atzmecha B'Mutalecha, what a religion. The Catholic religion suffers until today. Priests can't marry. I have scandal after this scandal right now. Some famous right-wing Catholic, a woman who was a satanic Catholic. That's a religion, and it still exists. It's beyond my comprehension. Wow. So Rabbi Tides, Jimmy Carter, no one paid attention to him. They were sure he's not going to be president. They spent their time and effort with other candidates. Rabbi Tides said, who knows? It seems that Rabbi Tides had discussed this matter with the Lubavitcher, and the Lubavitcher told him, be in touch with Carter too. Who knows what's going to happen? He invited Jimmy Carter to visit his community in Elizabeth. And you know, Rabbi Tides ran a real kehila, and he spoke, and it was on broadcast, on the television, on the radio, and this letter came from Jimmy Carter's Jewish consul. The letter ended by saying, should you ever need to call on us, the White House will be open to you. Rabbi Tides said to this Breslova, I have this letter for several years already. I never had a reason to use it. But maybe it was all for Reb Nachman. And Rabbi Tides called Robert Lipschitz. A few days went by, and there's Min HaShemayim. There was going to be the first meeting in decades between the President of the U.S. and the General Secretary of the USSR, Leonid Brezhnev. And they were meeting in Vienna, I remember this. And they soon learned that Lipschitz had spoken to Carter. Carter agreed to bring the issue up at the meeting. Within 2 weeks, they got an official letter from the USSR ambassador to the United States. Remember, Antolia Dobrynin, if I'm pronouncing his name right. And he delivered a message to the White House that they'll build buildings but they will go nowhere near the sacred ground of the burial place of Rabbi Nachman. So I think this story opens your eyes who Rabbi Teitz was, who the Lubavitcher Rebbe was. And I believe this story proves my thesis. I'm a hothead. I'm a demonstrator. I was at the rallies. I helped Triple SJ whatever I could. I don't have to apologize. But I always understood that Rabbi Teitz plays a role, Rabbi Schneier plays a role. They can accomplish what we can't. We can create public interest. We can create a movement that ultimately results in 1.5 million Jews, 2 million Jews getting out of Russia. We can create the feeling it must be achieved, it must be done, it must be accomplished. But people like Rabbi Teitz and Rabbi Schneier have a role to play quietly behind the scenes, with a smile, within the system. All right, so I just want to say that because it was a very valid question that Mark Lich asked. Why don't you mention Rabbi Teitz? But I want you to understand the difference between Rabbi Teitz and Meir Kahana. Okay. Now, let's come back to Meir's life. Again, I trust you'll hear last week's shiur, and I can't repeat it. I appreciate your being here tremendously, but I have to move further. Because I have one Talmud who's been my Talmud for 30 years, and he remembers every shiur, and he's a rabbi, and he'll say to me, Aaron, you said that 10 years ago, 12 years ago, I said something in Sunday Shir, the Kuntres HaShach, a week ago. He said, didn't you say, I spent the 2.5 years on it, but that was years ago. I just mentioned it in passing to tie it in with the Marashtam and the Tshuva of the Reb Menashe Klein. Okay, now, so here's Meir Kahana, and he didn't succeed in the rabbinate. He was viewed, you know, as there's something enigmatic about him. And he gets involved with Soviet Jewry, and this is to his eternal credit. Everything that comes afterwards can come about because he puts the issue on the front burner. That's the way you have to view it. By the late 60s, something else happens. And here you have to understand, America's starting to shift, America's starting to change. They just took down the statue of Robert E. Lee in one of the southern cities. They're taking down statues, took down statues of Columbus. It wasn't good to the Native Americans. You have people in Congress that are cursing Jews in public, two Democratic ladies, representatives, one from New York, one from Detroit, accusing Jews at the State of Israel of killing Arab kids. We go around, people like Rakefet walk around killing Arab kids daily. And they can say this in the halls of Congress and democracy. If you look back at the 20th century, one of the biggest changes, sea changes, is of course the revolution to give equal rights to the black people, the Afro-Americans, as they call themselves. And you have to really feel what America was like, where Norm lives today in Georgia. At one time, if a black lady got on a bus and sat in the white section, they screamed at her and pushed her to the back. You had black help working for you, and you had a separate toilet, a separate bathroom. The lady or the man, they were not allowed to use a bathroom that white people use. One of the great culture shocks people have when they come to Israel from the United States is they see Israelis, more than half the Israelis are basically black, not white, not Caucasian, or certainly mixed in with non-Caucasian looks. What was his name, the comedian who just died?
Jackie Mason.
One of his favorite lines and one of his most brilliant lines, and this is after the Six Day War, Jackie Mason says, "I went to Israel, or is it Israel? Boy, are they smart in Israel. They hire all the Puerto Ricans to drive the tanks," quote, end quote. Barack, do you get it? You don't get it. Puerto Ricans are dark. They're not totally black, but they're not totally Caucasian. And here in Israel, all the Sfardim, who's driving the tanks, who's serving in the army? But that was the Jackie Mason line. A lot came out now, you know, with Reb Moshe Feinstein, that he had smicha for Reb Moshe, and they retained their relationship. Reb Moshe, believe me, you don't break a relationship off. And I taught members of his family, and they hated him with a passion, because he was a Mechallel Shabbos, I gather. But I told them, listen, all the other Jews who made it big in Hollywood, they married Goyim. At least he married a Jew and remained, you know, a good, proud Jew. Ribbono shel Olam, you can't be overly angry at him. I mean, believe me, that he left Torah. I wish Jackie Mason would come and study with me. I would have had him davening 3 times a day, not because he has to, because he wants to. Okay, but that's. But give credit. At least he remained. So on the basic Jewish identity, he remained. Anyway, so you see, originally Martin Luther King. Who marched with Martin Luther King? Avram Yeshua Heschel, the Kapishtim Tzerebi's son. The brother of the Kapishtim Tzerebi. And again, Avram Yeshua Heschel, I know relatives of his, I was very close to relatives of his. And they told me he nishtafelt amincha. He would daven 3 times a day. He didn't miss mincha. That's an expression in Yiddish. Someone very pious, to daven shachrit is no big deal. You wake up in the morning, all right, the first thing you do, you daven. Before you go to bed, you remember to daven marva. In the middle of the day, hustle, bustle, running, doing, coming, going. Not to forget to daven mincha. That's an achievement. In my life, twice I forgot to daven mincha. Twice. In high school, when between terms, if you had over a 90 average, you were exempt from the finals. This is my earliest years in MTA. Later they abolished it because you should learn how to take tests. And I had 2 weeks off, something I never had in my life. And twice, I was so busy, I didn't have the schedule, the yeshiva, the davening, twice. So I davened Marav twice. I knew enough to, how to make mashlim, but I never missed a mincha from that time on. Okay? That shows commitment. And Avram Yeshua Heschel, who marched with Martin Luther King? And then, again, you take Malcolm X. I don't want to go into the whole story. Malcolm X, Islam, Muslim. Oh, already he's not with Martin Luther King. It's a whole new movement. And a movement that's much deeper with enmity to the Caucasian, particularly the Jew, become Islamic, and they take on Islamic names, Muhammad, Ribbono shel Olam, and the way they live. And by the way, I got to say that he personally, from the time he became a Muslim, if his biography is correct and it's a scholarly work, he didn't play around with women. He had a wife. He was loyal. He was furious at one of the founders of the whole Islamic movement who played around with all his secretaries. You follow? Shem Yirachem. What people can do. I know the rabbis. Lo aleinu, they had smicha, proper smicha, but what they became. So I can tell you stories that your hair will stand on edge, what humans act like animals. But you got to give credit. But part of that shift into Islam Islamic culture and the whole belief that this is the way to rise above what we have suffered from the Christians, there was a lot of anti-Semitism involved. And this started reflecting, for instance, anyone in the school system. Vic, you taught in the New York school system. Late 60s already, they were trying to push in too many Jews are teaching. We don't want these Jews teaching. Retire, get out. Pushing in, positions would open. Someone Afro-American, they took over, even if they didn't have the good credit and track record that the Jewish candidate had. And then it wound up already on the streets. Jews were beaten up, Jews were hit, people were bothered, people were troubled. Kippot. And that's when Reb Meir came up with the concept of the Jewish Defense League. Now, you today take this as a given. You don't realize in his time that was revolutionary. And here I'll come back to something I wrote in Washington. And I think this captures the picture very, very well. I grew up in the Bronx. Bronx filled with Jews, filled with Catholics, filled with Irish, filled with Italians, later filled with Puerto Ricans, Afro-Americans, etc. We had yeshiva 6 days a week. It's only the only parochial school in the Bronx. It began in Harlem over 100 years ago. And then it moved to the Bronx to a number of locations. Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yisrael Salanta began in Harlem as a Talmud Torah, then became a day school. Then it moved to Washington Avenue, and then they bought the old telephone building on Webster Avenue. And they were in that building for many years until the neighborhood changed. And then they merged with Akiva Academy from better area of the Bronx, University Heights, and then they merged with Riverdale. Sar Academy is Solanta Akiva Riverdale, and it's in Riverdale today, a very different school than the one I went to. Riverdale, Sar Academy, an open school, a little left wing, identifies to a certain degree with Chovevei Torah. In my days, Solanta, when the Shanghai crowd came in, We were walking the streets of Mir and Rotten and Brisk. It was a different experience. So we had school 6 days a week. Friday, half a day, and Sunday, half a day. In addition to five other full days, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, four other full days. Half a day Sunday, half a day Friday, Shabbos obviously off. Sunday morning you go to school, America was still a religious country. Today, in God we trust, it's a joke, it's an aphorism, it has no meaning in reality. President of the United States, supposedly a Catholic, no one is more in favor of abortion. I mean, the man, what's going on now with Texas? And he opens his mouth, have you given birth? I've used that too. When someone bothers me about that, I daven Shalosh, Sonny Yisha, you're embarrassing your wife. You idiot. When you can give birth, then we'll talk about Shalosh, Sonny Yisha. Look at Moshe Samuel's introduction to the translation of Mendelssohn, Jerusalem into English, 1830. Oh my gosh. So, look at the poop. You're a believer. You're a Catholic. This is basic to Catholic. And look at the cowardness of the Catholic Church that they don't condemn the president. There's a whole fight going on with him. The liberals versus the conservatives. They don't condemn the president. He can be Mechallel Shabbos Beprahesia, and the rabbis don't say a word. Yet get the meaning? Abortion? Why? Taking on Texas, taking on the Supreme Court, etc., etc. Taking on the New York Times. Okay. There was a big sea change. and Jews were beaten up. We never thought of fighting back. We went to Solanter on Sunday. The Catholic kids were going to church. They saw these damn Jewish kids going with their books. What? This is an insult. This is the Lord's day. And you're going to school? And some of these hot-headed kids used to beat us up. But watch. We would go in a group of kids, four or five kids. Two kids would come along and throw our briefcases into the gutter. We never thought of fighting back. It never entered our minds. I remember, I write about this, there were nuns at the bus stop. And I was a chabzik nicht geschämt. Do you know what that means? I don't know, how do you translate? Chab nicht geschämt. I wasn't ashamed. I went over to the nuns. I said to them, sisters, why don't you stop these kids from fighting with us, spitting at us, throwing our books into the gutter? And the nuns answered what they answered. I'll tell you what the answer was. They said, look, these kids are juvenile delinquents. They're not going to listen to us anyway. All right, that was their answer. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. I don't know if a nun came over to me and I'm a Catholic kid, I think I would have listened, but all right. We never thought of fighting back. The Rav says in Kol Dodi Dofek, I need not tell you what that piece is. Barak, are you familiar with Kol Dodi Dofek? The Rav, we never fought back. We never had an army. And the state of Israel created a miracle, whether willy-nilly, whether we like it or not. You remember what I always quote Golda Meir, that I'll never forgive the Arabs for forcing our boys to become murderers. It's a deep thought, believe me. But if we are not murderers, we wouldn't be here. And the state of Israel created a new mentality. And I have to say, you got to give Meir credit. He was the first one. We have to defend ourselves. Jewish Defense League. Out of that Jewish Defense League, no, have you seen the news? Who here comes from Flatbush? Anybody? Shlomo, you from Flatbush? No. Okay, Zach, Flatbush? No. Flatbush. Did you see the announcement? All Yontif, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, the Shomrim, their police cars are going to be going back and forth. And they're telling you they're being driven by retired non-Jewish policemen. You follow what I'm saying? That this JDL gave birth to Shomrim societies, call it what you want, and all over the world today. It's not just in America. This was picked up already in South Africa. It was picked up in England. You have Jews caring about defense. I can tell you in Flatbush, Friday night, people have been accosted, have been assaulted. I can tell you Beverly Hills, they have had problems Friday night. It's beyond words. Some of it is anti-Semitic. Some of it is stump. Rob, get some. Rabbi Rackman, I remember Rabbi Rackman giving a psak that you're allowed to carry what did he permit? A $5 bill or a $1 bill in your hat on Shabbos? The whole question of when we worked for the Mossad in communist Russia, so you couldn't leave. Remember, you have your passport, you have your visa, you have your money. You could not leave it in the hotel, because it would be not robbed, it would be taken away, and you couldn't budge without it. The day you're to leave, the police would contact you. Oh, it has been returned. See how good the Russian people are? And that way they grounded you. And I can tell you cases where this happened, But we were instructed, you must always carry it with you. What do you do Shabbos? Remember I told you it's a machlokes whether it's better to put it in your shoe or put it in your hat. I have my famous hat that I can show you, that I have a pocket in the top of it where I kept my passport, my visa, my money, and that way it's above 10 tfachim, so it's mokum ptur. You follow? And if it's in your sock, it's betoch three tfachim, it's lavud, it's part of the ground, it's not, but it's better in the hat than the sock because it's more comfortable when it's in the sock. It's hard to walk, and you don't want to get caught in a position like that. But with this, what Meir began, all right, I admit Meir was inspired by Israel. Never again, followed, what did never again mean? Never again, not the Holocaust. And later here in Israel, never again means don't let the Arabs spit in our face. Never again, never again. Rakach, Meir, ADL, JDL, Jewish Defense League. All right, I have to tell you, when Meir began the Jewish Defense League, there was, I would say, if not total acceptance, 90% acceptance. Even I can have it documented, Temple Emanuel at times called upon the JDL to patrol its parameters when they had something affair going. Problem with Meir, and why later on and until today you find people snicker, JD, Jewish Defense League, and Meir. So you see, here you come into a problem that haunts us. Do we take the law into our own hands? Or do we depend upon a government? I have to tell you, this question came up right here in this room last year. Halacha l'masa. I had a group of students last year from the Kollel, the finest individuals. Some of them had settled in Israel, Israeli citizens. One of them was, where's a Shtreimel Shabbos? Satmar, big Satmar Yichus, that much I can tell you. But a total YU person who we understood each other 1,000%. I would show him, whenever I got an email from Satmar, I would show it to him because I said, you have to go back and help those who want to come into the big world be successful, not throw away the baby with the bathwater. So there's no question. At times, a government has other considerations. I told you something yesterday that is very true and very deep and very troubling, and you can debate it endlessly. Government sits down, they make a cheshbon, wow, this is great, only 10 Jews were killed this year. Don't fight back. Don't. Tit for tat, let the Arabs get away, don't cause an explosion, don't blow up Har HaBayit. Don't. And I don't know, at times I feel to lose 10 Jewish lives, we should strike hard the minute you pick up a rock to throw at a Jew. And now, let me give you an example. The Arabs are throwing rocks at Jewish cars. This goes on all the time. A lot of my Talmidim and a lot of Jewish youth here, they would like to pick up rocks and throw them at Arab cars. And unfortunately it's done. Just this week they arrested, five Jewish youth threw rocks at Arabs work for Egid. Buses running to Givat Zev. They injured two Arab drivers, harmed the buses. I Talmidim came to me, the old city, they wanted to get involved. There were incidents last year, Jews were killed. Police aren't strong enough. My dear students, I want to say the following. This is my point of view. If we take things into our own hands, we have total pandemonium. My father's Zichrono Levracha used to say, I brought my parents to Aliyah in 77. My father did not have a Richa Jumim here, but my mother did. But my father used to say, after being here a few months, he said, if the Arabs were smart, they absolutely wouldn't say anything, be silent, we would wind up killing each other. The Jews, the Machlekes, would destroy us completely. And in my humble opinion, this is what Pirkei Avot says, have you been Palel l'shlama shel malchut? If we don't have a kingdom, we'll eat each other up alive. Ishat chaveru below. And here we have a real problem. We come from a religion, it's the only religion in the world that stresses knowledge. No one has to tell me about knowledge. I'm a Litvak. And to me, a Jew, I have nachat mamay, I have grandchildren tell me they do daf yomi. I'm willing to give them $1 million a piece if I should only have that to give to them. I would ruin their lives by that. That's a different story. But I jump for joy, learning. Norm Schles knows me half a centenary already. And learning, Mark. What a world we have. But then there's a big problem. The minute we learn and we become, oh, we're smart. Then we're smarter than anyone else. And some of you know I have many opinions, but I will always say at the end of the day, there are other opinions out there. The minute we start taking to the law in our own hands, where does it end? Take a look what happened in Afghanistan. ISIS, if I'm pronouncing it right, are killing Taliban. I couldn't understand that. I said, what's going on here? So my grandchildren explained to me that Taliban is not religious enough for the ISIS. You follow? So again, we're going to start killing and shooting. And by the way, there are Jews, you see it occasionally, hatred towards Haredim, hatred towards Reform. No. If we have a government, I tell everyone, you have a problem, put the pressure on the government. The greatest statement ever made was that in democracy, our ballot is our bullet. I repeat, our ballot is our bullet. It's a democracy. They're political parties. It's not communist Russia. It's not Stalin, as we began this year an hour ago. Put pressure. Discuss. Talk. Vote. You see Bennett as being accused of robbing the vote of the people? All right, I don't know if he is or isn't. He established the government. It's a legal government. I'm not happy with it. My son-in-law is furious. My eldest son-in-law, my daughter says, give him a chance, his wife. My grandchildren are more with their father than their mother. But we're going to have an election 3 years from now, whatever will be. Go, vote, demand, let it show. You have a right, yell, shout. But when we take the law into our own hand, it's ein ledaber sof. Because each one will say, I'm right, I'm the tzaddik, I'm the chacham, you're the idiot, you're the ignoramus, you're the amoritz. We get nowhere that way. Just machleket upon machleket upon machleket. All right, this is where the opposition begins to Meir Kahana. People, ADL, ultimately harassing Russian diplomats, ultimately bombing Saul Hurak's office, happened to be Jewish. He brought entertainers, that was his business, and they blow up the office. The secretary, I believe, 27-year-old lady, I have the exact facts, but I'll tell it to you next time. They blow up the office. They kill that lady. This is a serious matter. Metzicha, Jews, people went to jail. All right? Where do you draw the line? And this question haunts us. In my humble opinion, we must always work within the legal system. The greatness of Israel is it's a democracy. If Ben-Gurion would have had seichel, he would have said you can only vote if you eat chazer on Yom Kippur. His wife, Ben-Gurion's wife, Paula, he was never really married. She refused to have a Jewish wedding. They were married by a civil servant in New York City. He was exiled then. It was World War I, and they were exiled to New York, and that's where he married her. But he was more accommodating. He came from home, but he threw it all away. She had enmity. She had hatred. I can tell you, when I came in Aliyah, I met two Israelis, and they were talking. They were soldiers. They're no longer alive, obviously. It's 50-plus years ago. And they were middle-aged at the time. And I remember they were sitting around and recollecting. And they told the story. Once they got out of their army, they were going home. They had to leave. And it wasn't like today with buses. And today you can't travel anyway because there's too many buses and cars on the roads. And they got a lift in Ben-Gurion's official car. And Ben-Gurion is sitting in the driver. Ben-Gurion is in front, or Paul is sitting in front, and Ben-Gurion is sitting in back, and two soldiers get in. They give them the lift. They were going down south. Ben-Gurion's going back to his kibbutz, and Stay Boker, right? Is that the kibbutz he comes from? Stay Boker. And these two soldiers take off their kumtot, their army berets, and they're wearing kippot, and she was sitting there burning, furious. They tell about Chaim Weizmann's wife. Again, the same story. And Chaim Weizmann, too, did not have this enmity. It's amazing. When women go, they go all the way. Julia Hart. Wow. Unbelievable. They go all the way. And they tell the story. Chaim Weizmann, they built Weizmann Institute. I mean, he got Israel dynamite. You know what I'm talking about, right? You got to give Weizmann all the credit. By the way, members of his family were from in Israel. His nephew, who was president, had a lot of feelings that I was born a Torah Jew and I will die a Torah Jew. He couldn't stand the reform. And he wasn't that from, but he knew what it was about. But part of his family did become from. And so he died, Chaim. She still lived on campus. Morty Tarragon would know all the details. He worked in Rehovot. He worked in research there. And she lived on campus, and these are stories that are documented, that when a Jew walked onto the Weizmann campus in Hasidic garb, she would be livid with rage that such people could still be alive. So I have to tell you, the original Mapai, and I'm not here to give them any credit, they had that whole concept, a new Jew, a new dawn, throw away all of religion. What they did to the Sephardic kids, what they did to the kids from Tehran, those were Ashkenazi kids, say, from Hitler. They went in and put them into kibbutzim, where they took chickens and broke their necks. We don't need shechita here anymore. I'm not. But they were stupid. They should have said, you can only have the right to vote if you eat chazer on Yom Kippur. Bring a document. Witnesses. Baruch Hashem, everyone has the right to vote in Israel. And if you notice, it's a much more right-wing country. Even Lapid is nowhere near what the left was originally. So this is the way I think. And I understand the reticence people have. If we start taking the law into our own hand, and this was Meir, he tried, okay, but give him credit. JDL, it lives on until today. If in Flatbush, cars are going around with Hebrew lettering, Shomrim, on Shabbos and on Yom Tov, and they have to publish ads and let you, by the way, they're raising money to pay the retired police people. Now, these people don't do it for nothing. They get paid. And they're raising money so that they should have all the patrols. I understand it. Click here if you want to contribute. All right? You can see it online. I think I saw it this morning on Yeshiva World News, if I'm not mistaken. Or I saw it last night on Yeshiva World News. So, Mayor JDL, he was revolutionary. And it affects us until today outside the state of Israel. But I add the addendum, the footnote, within the letter of the law. In Israel, one of the great achievements of Israel, when Israel was established, the Eitzel and Lechi and Haganah, all three joined together. And this was the greatness of Menachem Begin. As much as Ben-Gurion hated him, and there was enmity, Ben-Gurion used to say, Lo maki v'lo cheirut. I'll never have anything to do with the Mifleget Communistic Yisraelit, maki, the Communist Party, and the cheirut. Ben-Gurion refused to take revenge. Remember, they shut up the ship, the Atlena, on the beach. Yitzhak Rabin gave the order, which is, I mean, shocking when you think a man who gave the order to kill Jews, and they killed, what was it, 7 or 8, was later killed by a Jew. I mean, it's frightening. But Menachem Begin never went that way, and he insisted that which unites us is infinitely more important than that which divides us. All right. This is JDL. With the JDL activities, Menachem Begin, Mayor Kahana winds up in jail, halfway houses, and here I can tell you one of the cutest stories. In one of his jail sentences in the 70s in New York, you know, illegal weapons, arms, demonstrations, illegal harassing, Soviets, there were many reasons that they were able to put him on trial, and afterwards, at first there was only parole, and afterwards they got more serious. Finally they got rid of him, he went on Aliyah. But one of the nicest stories, he was in a halfway house now. I think he had a year sentence and 6 months for Rova, and the halfway house was on the Upper East Side. So he called Rabbi Lichtstein, it's Haskell, Rabbi Lichtstein Jr., and told him Shabbos he's going to be in the halfway house. He'd like to come over and have a Shabbos meal with Rabbi Lichtstein. And Rabbi Lichtstein said, absolutely. And he's preparing the children. I taught 3 of the 4 children. Or I taught 4 out of 4 already. I got to figure it out. And he's preparing the children. And Mayor Kahana's coming, and you know, the kids, they told me they were all spiked up, like, who knows who's going to walk in, and that, like, a guy, a tiger with big teeth, and knuckles, and brass knuckles, and Mayor comes, the sweetest, nicest guy alive, Davins, and like, and then friendly and smiling, and that was Mayor. Then by the 1970s already, Mayor, you know, you grow older and more mature, what is life about, and what am I doing in America, and never again. And there's one obvious conclusion: you got to go in Aliyah. And Mayor comes in Aliyah. And we'll go into it in more detail after Sukkot. But the story of Mayor's Aliyah, I have to tell you, his family totally integrated. I taught his two daughters were both my students. His son-in-law was my Talmud Mufak. His daughter-in-law was my student. This is all on a collegiate level. And I can tell you, the family totally integrated. Libby, should live and be well, Libby Blum Kahana. She, a very intelligent lady with a bachelor's and a master's, I believe in library science. She worked at the Hebrew University Library for decades in charge. If anyone had a research question, where to look, what to do, what books to get started with, she was in charge. She's tremendous help. And here too, no one, if you knew Libby, you wouldn't in a million years dream that she's married to an atomic bomb like Meir. It is the children, Meir, just his youngest son, who was Lembeth killed by terrorists with his wife. He was the one, the youngest one, Binyamin Zev, was the one who was the most like his father. It's interesting. The older son and the two daughters, by the way, Tzipi is not alive anymore. She died a few years ago. My Tommy died. Moshe remarried, Mark remarried, and for me it's living history. Meir had a more difficult time in Israel than he did in America, and I'll tell you why. In America, if you worked outside the system, but there's a certain feeling in America, look, he's a rabbi, he's Jewish, the Jews have been persecuted, Jews have suffered World War II, they tolerated Meir. Time and again, they would arrest him, and they charged him, they didn't charge him, they sentenced him, they paroled him. In other words, there was always an element of a little bit mercy. This man means well. I mean, even the biggest Gentile could understand, never again, 6 million Jews butchered, killed, God have mercy. What we have gone through. In Israel, there was much less tolerance. Because, first of all, it's a Jewish state. It's an Israeli government. They're quoting Rakefet, what I told you a minute ago. If you have any complaints, don't use a bullet, use a ballot. You understand? And in Israel, too, we're much more sensitive because it's a small country. In America, you have so many different states. It's a vast country. There's no question that New York and California, the two coasts, are one world in America. And then when you go between them, you hit a different country altogether. The Bible Belt and the cities that don't have as much crime and murder. What goes on in New York? I come from New York, so maybe it interests me the most. But every day you look at the headlines in the New York Post, 3 people murdered, 4 people murdered, day in and day out. Just a man was killed by a guy in Hasidic dress. I mean, it's beyond comprehension. A Hasid is making believe his car stalled, and he's watching the car across the street. And there's a young man coming to the car across the street. The chassid, it's all videoed. The chassid walks over and blows him away in broad daylight.
It was a chassid. It was a hitman dressed up as
dressed. He was dressed as a chassid. He was a hitman for whoever was out to get him. But imagine, he went to some Satmar tailor, bought a whole outfit. It's beyond comprehension. All he was missing was a shtreimel. But maybe he knew enough that you only wear a shtreimel on Shabbos Yontif or a Simcha. But beyond comprehension. So Meir comes to Israel. And here already he's thrown into jail. You'll see that jail has a big impact on him, a big impact on his thinking. And I'll spend a lot of time on this because what Meir, the problems he raised were very legitimate. Not all his solutions, at least I feel, are not that totally legitimate. but the problems were real. And he saw that in jail. And you'll see, I have a lot to say about this after Sukkot Be'ezrat Hashem. And then when he saw it's Israel and you can't import your own weapons and you can't bring your own system, he suddenly, evidently reached the conclusion that Rakefet is right. The Knesset, the parliament. And he forms a political party. And everyone is laughing. Who is this man? And finally, in 1984, he is elected to the Knesset. A few years later, when they're going to run another election, the country went crazy because the polls showed that he would pull anywhere from 8, 9, 10, 11 seats, and even if you say, Midvaseka Tirchak, got me, Zach? Midvaseka? Midvaseka Tirchak, do you know that pasuk from the Torah? An Israeli variation, Midvaseka. Seka means a pole. Seka, Samach, Kufresh, Samach instead of Shin. Midava Seka Tirchak. Don't remain, the polls can be wrong. But even if the polls were wrong, and he was going to have a lot more representation, and that's when they voted that the party, the Supreme Court upheld it, is a party beyond the law, and in my humble opinion, that was a tragic mistake. You'll ask me after Sukkot, I'll give you a little bit insight into what happened, and Chaim Herzog, etc., etc. Okay. Then, of course, Meir is still traveling back and forth, and that fateful night in Manhattan where he gives a talk in public, what was it, 1990? In public, before hundreds of people, and he's assassinated, and the Arab is put on trial and found innocent. Could you imagine? We're talking about America. You see already how America is shifting gears. A legal system, jury. Finally, they rearrest him. They put him on trial on a federal charge. And a federal he interfered with mayor's civil rights, etc., etc. And then he's put away into jail, and the rest is history. Okay, so what did we do today? First of all, I'm very frightened. Yomo, I am very frightened. I don't want to go through again the Agmas Nefesh I had today. My health cannot take it. Do you understand me? What do we do? There has to be a solution. The building is not Hefka, there has to be a solution. And I'm very worried because I'm teaching the first class. I begin the Sunday after Sukkot, I'm the first class after Sukkot. Do you understand, do you fellas understand, Barak, do you understand how to work the system here? Who understands? Solomon, Shlomo, do you understand? Can you sit down with Yomo, take him by the ears like a KGB agent, remind him of the Ukraine where he was born, sit down with him, when does Sukkot end? Let me not be clear. Thursday, right? Thursday is already Istruchak, am I right?
October 3rd is the first year.
Which is Sunday. But I want them to sit down on the Sunday or Friday before, test the system, and see that it works. And if there's any problem, you contact Professor Tarragon and get insight from him what's wrong, okay?
Unfortunately, I'm not here then. I'm leaving October 3rd in the morning early.
For?
America.
Your brother again?
Yeah.
It should only be with good news. Where's Charlie? I don't see Charlie online.
He probably couldn't get on at the beginning and then didn't come back.
So what can we do? What can we do? All right. Anyway, let me not hold everyone up. To reiterate, first of all, I want to thank. I have a classroom. All those listening across the world and looking at me on the little screen, I want to tell you there are more people sitting in this classroom right now than have sat in the classroom in the last year and a half. Halavai, you fellas bring in a little more, and we'll be alive and kicking Sunday, Monday, Be'ezrat. I met an old-timer who knows me 70 years yesterday. I was crawling up the steps from Berlin to Chalap to catch Mincha. So he looks at me, Aaron, how you doing? I say, Sunday, Monday, I was 23 years old this morning. I'm younger than anyone in the class. But now you're seeing an 83-year-old man trying to climb up the steps from Berlin to Chalap. I hope that we come back on that Sunday. I can be 23, not 83, Be'ezrat Hashem. What did we do today? We did a little bit more material on Shlomo Lekalbach. We did on Rabbi Teitz. That was a good question. I love it that Mark asked me, why don't you mention Rabbi Teitz? I just finished writing about him. You'll understand when you read it, you'll understand why I didn't mention him. But once I got the question, let me be honest, and there are no two ways about it. We need, in my humble opinion, both. We got to yell and shout, but you got to work quietly behind the scenes. Unfortunately or fortunately, that's the way life works. Vitamin P, do you know what that means? That's smut in Hebrew. Vitamin P. Vitamin P. You better learn these words or you won't succeed in Israel. Do you know what the word tafran means? I'll tell you some other time. That's one of the slang words that saved my life in the army. Vitamin P always helps, and that was Rabbi Teitz. Meir Kahana is, to understand Meir, you got to understand him in context. What I spoke about last week, his five relatives being killed by Arabs in 1937. You have to understand what happened in Howard Beach. Meir, unbelievably capable, unbelievably charismatic. And this was his life. We detailed it. We didn't go into... We gave you the main features. Be'ezrat Hashem, after Sukkot, I'm going to analyze more the intellectual part of Meir's life and how we relate to it, what it created. You'll see that I think to a certain degree he was responsible for the birth of Shas. And I'll show it to you. I'll call your attention to it. But Be'ezrat Hashem, leave that for after Sukkot. Are there any questions now in the classroom? If there are no questions in the classroom, yeah.
Howie. There was an organization, Al-Tidor, Rabbi Harry Bronstein.
Yeah.
Is that not in the...
No, Harry Bronstein was a Yiddish tzaddik. He did Mila in the Soviet Union.
He
brought in, and then he had a heart attack. They
right.
caught him, and...
Don't
ask. You don't know what people were Meisa Nefesh for Soviet Russia. Okay? Malka and I gave up 10 years of our life. I mean, you don't start. I mean, this is not baloney. This is a fact. We lived it. We were younger. Today we couldn't do it. We lived a dual existence. If this was 1980, I'd be looking at you and thinking, oh, do you live here? Do you have Israeli citizenship? You're a candidate for going to Russia. We were looking for candidates. You don't know what we went through. And then, when we finally got candidates, they used to do a security check. And occasionally, it came back, this guy couldn't go. And you don't know what I went through, because I had to bluff my way out of it. I had one guy, I come into the secret place in Tel Aviv, and Aryeh Kroll, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, the boss who got Pras Yisrael for his work, says, what kind of lowlifes are your friends? And he shows me this rabbi who I knew intimately, who gave up teaching and got involved in building and making money, He was arrested. They bring him up on charges of extortion. Okay? By the way, he never was found guilty. But he couldn't go. Heard the KGB. Now I say to Arya, Arya, mani agitlo. He said, lo tabaya shelcha. So now, what the heck do I do? So I said, tareli et kadok. Show me from the shin bet what. So I see this guy after the Yom Kippur War. Before the Yom Kippur War, Americans were not taken into the army. The State Department objected. After the Yom Kippur War, Israel took everyone walking. You're looking at someone who did basic training at the age of 38. Okay, it was the Chayil Mitzrayim, 38 years of age. So what do you do with them afterwards? A guy 36, 37, 38, 39 was the cutoff. What do you do? I became very important in the army. From their point of view, wow, I was a senior lecturer in the rabbinate. I went all over. I lectured. I spoke. Oh, but the other guy. So the army, believe it or not, every word I'm telling you is true. On my behemoth kid, the army ran a course spotting enemy aircraft. There's a big building at the entrance to Meir Sharim. It used to be a Histadrut building. Today it's all Haredi. On the roof of the building, you would look, where's the plane coming? And they would teach you to say, 12 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 9 o'clock. You follow? You spotted a plane. And they would have two guys on the building every night. So this guy took that course. So I say to him, Yankala, did you take a special course in the army? A very mashu ma'od sodi, very secretive. He says, yeah, we took that stupid course. What morons were going to stand on the building in spot place? I say, anyone who took that course can't go to Russia for 20 years. They're afraid the KGB will, you know, spot it and put you in jail. So, and you know what the funniest part is? He believed me. That's the funniest part. Gentlemen, are there any questions from across the world? Can you unmute if there are any questions? I apologize for finishing so late, but we got started very late. Any questions? No. Okay. I want to wish everyone a gemar chatima tova and
Nia.
Rabbi. Yeah.
Rabbi, I just wanted to say two things. One, you know, it was just 9/11 on Sunday.
Right.
And any time there's a book or a movie made about 9/11, they always begin with Merrick Ahada being killed.
Ah.
Because the guy who planned it, years later, he blew up the World Trade Center once, and then years later, he blew it up a second time. So they always start by saying, nobody wanted to think that there was anything, oh, some nut killed him, you know,
right, some Arab. Right,
right. And they were like, nobody wanted to say there was a conspiracy, there was a guy in New Jersey, they didn't want to say, and so they ended up destroying the World Trade Center.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, good. I'm happy to hear that.
I one other thing I wanted to say, you know, Michael Ben-Ari, who was, I think, in Americana's party,
right.
He told us a story once. He said the librarian of the Knesset came to him and said, when he was in the Knesset, he said, we're doing an exhibit of all the books that were written by Knesset members over the years. Like any book. So what do you think I should put in for Merrick Ahada? You know, like what safer should I put up that he put up? So Michael Ben-Ari said, oh, you know, he wrote a lot of Sfarim. He wrote dozens of Sfarim.
Right,
he
right.
He picked out like a couple of good ones. So the librarian said, yeah, you know, Ruby Rivlin, who was the speaker, he didn't want us to put anything but Merrick Ahada up. And I said, look, every Knesset member is a Knesset member. If you wrote a safer, he wrote a safer. So they said, okay, so they picked out a safer, they put it on display. And then he leans over to Michael Ben-Ari and he says, Ruby Rivlin hasn't written a single book in his life.
I'm glad they didn't say Ruby Rivlin hasn't read a single book in his life. That would have been a little worse. But I'll tell you, Ruby Rivlin is a Shemesh Shabbos. You should know that. So that much he has going for him. Yeah, Jay?
I wanted to say, and perhaps Rabbi Rubin can speak to this more authoritatively, but I wanted to point out how impactful JBL was in Boston, in particular, in the inner city. There was a very calamitous situation with broad neighborhoods of older Jewish citizens in the inner city that were essentially driven out as the demographics of the community changed, and they were victimized. They were victims of violence, and the JDL stepped in. And to my own mind, the JDL in Boston, as in other urban centers, represented a switch in the psyche from the post-Holocaust survivor mentality, and it emboldened the community into thinking, you know, we have the means to fight back.
Wow.
I think that's the underlying sociological phenomenon that occurred. Yitz Rubin was witness to it. We saw it with my wife's grandparents. They were literally driven out of the neighborhood.
Wow.
And a very rich Jewish community where the Rev actually settled. It's one of the reasons the Rev moved from Roxbury into Brookline, of course.
Right. I'll next time we meet, I'll substantiate what you're saying. I have something in a very cute little story that says it all. But that's exactly what we're saying. It was revolutionary what Meir did, that a Jew can fight back. A Jew can defend himself. Today it's taken for granted. I mean, what I told you about Flatbush is Merab Sinigra, that they're telling the people the police cars of the Shomrim will be all over the neighborhood, but don't worry, they're being driven by retired police officers. Yitz, did you want to say anything?
Rebbe, yeah. If I can just add to what we just heard, my father, Zichron of the Bracha, was once stopped by five Afro-Americans in the New York area in the 60s asking for his bus pass, and they all had knives. And he looked at them and said, did you hear the JDL? And they all ran away.
Wow. His father was my student. That's one of the early students of BMT. Yitz,
and a student of Meir Kahana in Yeshiva High School, Queens.
Ah, so that certifies what we said. Rabbi Rubin, did you want to say anything?
You're muted, Rabbi Rubin. Unmute yourself. There you go.
The quote from Golda Meir, it's not that she said she's sorry that the Arabs forced us to make our men soldiers and murderers. She said killers. There's a big difference. It's not just semantics. A murderer is a person who kills with intent and without a reason. Killing is different. In self-defense, it's killing. It's not murder.
She said that... I think I heard it in Hebrew, so it's my poor translation. Because I think she said this in one of her Erev Yom Kippur talks. It's when I came in Aliyah, she was prime minister, and she would speak to the nation before Yom Kippur. And she was very, very powerful. So what are you saying? That it should be killers? That's what you're telling me? That I used the wrong...
We had to teach our children to kill, because... But the kill is different because it's legitimate.
Alright, I accept that, but don't blame her, blame me. I think I heard it in Hebrew, because I heard it on the radio, so it had to be in Hebrew. Alright, until we meet again in health and happiness, Tas V'Danya, and Besorah Tovot Aleinu V'Al Kol Yisrael.